Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby is a professional motoring writer. He also undertakes paid contract work for various brands as an individual and in the course of his business. This commercial work is entirely separate from his editorial reviews. He's committed to accuracy and fairness in all he does, in all his reporting, and maintains full editorial control and independence across everything he does produce. Toby, good evening to you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Phil. Hello.
Good to have you with us too. Well, EVs have outsold petrol and diesel for the first time.
Yeah, it's a pretty big result. Obviously, we've seen EV sales growing, but now they're almost a quarter of the market, 24.9% of the market. And for the first time out selling pure petrol cars, we're pulling hybrid out of that and diesel as well. So
pure petrol and pure diesel, they've sold more than sell more than those.
Yeah. So it's whether that'll continue over the next few months, who knows? But the general sense in the industry is that this is now the momentum's built, and I haven't spoken to anyone who is expecting it to drop off substantially.
It's the Strait of Hormuz. That's triggered it, hasn't it?
Absolutely, that's had a huge impact, but so has the sheer number of models that are now available. So obviously, the buyers have got more choice. And in some instances, we're seeing fewer petrol and diesel models available. So take the Toyota RAV4, for example. It's hybrid only these days. You can't get a pure petrol version of it. So that obviously impacts buying to some extent. And also prices. These days there are EVs that are cheaper than the petrol alternative. So added all up.
Even a couple of years ago, that wasn't the case, but it now is.
Yeah.
Tesla Model Y was the top seller. Tesla was the third best-selling brand, even though it's only got two models of car to sell.
Only got two models, which is astonishing. So, and 6,400 Tesla Model Ys last month, which, to put that in perspective, I think Ford did 2,500-odd ranges. So that's sometimes the top-selling car. And Toyota Hilux was 5,000 something. So it's it's a huge number. So it's rocketing along, and it's and you look down the list of top selling brands, and it's interesting the Chinese starting to more and more Chinese brands appearing in that list. So the market is changing amazingly, and as you pointed out, the Japanese brands are down, so they're the ones getting hit hardest. Interestingly, the Korean brands, Hyundai and Kia, they're down a little bit, but year to date only about 1 or 2%. So it's not a massive drop for them, but certainly the Japanese are the ones feeling it hardest in terms of loss of sales.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Utes continuing to tumble. They're down for the month. Whether that stays that way, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been a trend the last sort of 6 or 12 months of ute sales starting to come off. So it's
have we fallen out of love with the ute, have we?
I wouldn't quite say that. There's still almost 1 in 5 sales. So it's still a substantial chunk of the market. But certainly, I mean, you look at it these days, there are more to choose from. We've got new entrants in there, mainly from Chinese brands. And rather than just diesel, which is dominated, you're starting to see more plug-in hybrids come in there. But, the ute market generally has eased a little bit. So people, whether they're saying, I don't need a ute anymore, or they're looking at SUVs or something else instead, either way, it's starting to come off a bit. So as one of the senior Toyota execs a year or two ago sort of called it and said, "Yeah, I think we've hit peak ute." So we're starting to come off a bit. So it's the days of sort of 21-22% was about the peak of it, and that's starting to come off.
Okay, other interesting things. Chinese cars, 40% of the cars sold in Australia are built in China.
Yep, and not all of them are Chinese brands, obviously. Tesla, all but one of the Teslas is out of China, and, Volvo's these days out of China, so it's there's other brands. There's mainstream brands that do export from China, but, the real bulk of it, the big volume, is obviously the newcomer brands.
The Ford Bronco Basecamp.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. So this is, the Bronco is a very famous nameplate for Ford, and they've confirmed this week that it is coming to Australia.
The boss of Ford told you it was.
He did, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a little bit different to the rough and full-on off-road Bronco that they get in America. We're getting the Bronco Base Camp, which is actually sort of more passenger car-like underpinning. So instead of that ladder frame architecture you get under a ute or a the big heavy-duty four-wheel drives, it's got more of a car-like construction underneath. It's got independent suspension. But they're doing a top-of-the-range model. It's got some interesting features. It's got like a pop-top roof, so it's designed for camping and looking at the stars and so on. So they've created selling an optional bed to go in the back of it. You can look at the stars. It's also got so it's a plug-in hybrid. It's got actually an extended range electric vehicle, which is a type of plug-in hybrid. And so I'll do about 200 k's in electricity, but it's also can power your campsite and so on. So you can, you know, power fridges and and lights and all that sort of stuff directly from the car. Yes, and a full size spare wheel. So it is designed to go off road, just not quite as hardcore off road as a Ford Everest or something like that. But that's coming out next year. It's going to be straight out of China. It is a Chinese built car, so it's interesting. Ford is sort of is one of the many brands turning to China, to Chinese manufacturers, to supply it with some cars that are going to be obviously sharply priced.
Yeah, indeed. They're doing the same with the Transit van.
Transit, yeah. So they've got
the famous.
That's it.
I mean, iconic Ford Transit van, but it's,
yeah, and Transit's huge in Europe. It's popular here. It is outsold here by the Toyota Hiace, but. There's two versions of the Transit in Australia already. We've got the Transit, which is the sort of big van, and then the Transit Custom, which is the slightly smaller one. This one's called the Transit City, which is smaller again, and it's not related at all to those two. So this Transit City is pure electric, only powered by an electric motor. It's actually built by JMC, which is one of Ford's Chinese manufacturing partners. They've got an ownership in it as well. And obviously, price is a big one. So it's going to be $50,000 drive away, and they think they can steal some sales off some of the diesel vans currently in the market. So going to be interesting to see if they can, because in that market, that van market, has been fairly resistant to electric vehicles to date.
It has.
Partly because of the prices, and that's one of the things here, is this one's pretty sharply priced, so maybe that will have an impact.
Yeah. Okay. Johnny from Geelong says, I recently bought a second-hand Tesla Model Y, still under warranty. I'm really happy. It was half the original retail price, 98% battery life. The big advantage when you go to get some minor repairs done, they know the car inside out because there's only two models. Very simple and effective way of managing car repairs.
Well,
he's very happy.
Two models, and the two models are very closely related. So most of the stuff under the skin is the same anyway. So you could almost argue it's one model. But yeah, I mean, look, that's good. It's interesting saying under warranty, because Tesla has had one of the least impressive warranties. It was 4 years, 80,000 kilometres. So they have stepped that up recently, but that car would have been a 4 year, 80,000 kilometre warranty. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm actually looking to write a story in the next month or so about residual values on EVs, because they did spike after the Iran war kicked off, and we saw sales of new ones come up, and they started to pick up on used EVs as well. So some of the bargains that were around, you know, 8 or 10 months ago aren't quite there now, but there's still some decent buying if you look around.
Okay, let's take some calls. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Paul from Blacktown, good evening to you.
Yes, g'day.
Phil's my name, and Toby's the expert.
Sorry, Phil, I just had a complete mental blank.
That's all right.
Because it's late in the evening.
It's not that late, Paul, but anyway, go on.
Depends on what time you got up, Phil.
Go on.
we've got a 2013 a Holden Calais, and we're looking at a swapping over to a hybrid. Mainly because we live in Sydney, and my wife wants to travel up to Newcastle sort of on a regular occasion to see her mum.
Yep.
And she's just a bit concerned about range of the EV just between here and Newcastle.
Yep.
The BYDs, we've heard mixed results or mixed things about their after sales service.
And there's the
C-Line, I think it is, which has got a which is electric hybrid, electric motor hybrid, which has got a 1,000K range, supposedly.
Yeah. So there's four sea lines. There's a sea line 5, 6, 7, and 8. The sea line 7 is pure electric. The other three are what you're talking about, those plug-in hybrids with high range. So you usually get, depends on the model, but call it 100, 150Ks. I think it's close to 100 on those of electric, and then it's going to switch over to just be a regular hybrid after that.
Mm-hmm. And the after-sale service, we've heard there was that kerfuffle at the start of the year about people who bought a 2020 seven or six bay hybrids, and they thought that was 2025 or something like that.
Other way around. They bought a 2025 thinking it was a 2026, and they got compensation for it. I wouldn't be looking too much into that. That was a one-off mistake that they addressed relatively quickly. They obviously got some media pressure and addressed it pretty quickly after that. In terms of after-sales support, certainly, looking at social media and so on in the early days of BYD, 2023, I think it was in Australia, they were copping some flack for not looking after people in the after-sales area in terms of, warranty support or parts and so on. They've expanded their dealer network significantly. The factory has come in and now is running the operations. So it's a different operation to what it was in those early days. And it's not unusual to see a newcomer brand come in and struggle on that after-sales side of thing. I was actually chatting to the boss of Chery Australia today, who pointed to how important that after-sales support was. And he said, we haven't got it perfect, but we're working really hard at it. And he has nominated that as one of the key things they've been working on since day one. I remember interviewing a couple of years ago, and he said, we are focusing heavily on after-sales support because they didn't want that criticism. So I can't vouch for, whether BYD's, as good or bad as the other brands now, other than to say it has improved. And I haven't personally heard anything like the negatives that we heard early on in that brand's arrival in Australia. So it wouldn't be putting me off, but as I said, I haven't dug too deeply. I certainly haven't had as much feedback on it.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Good luck with it. Look, with 40% of sales being EVs, I mean, this is...
No, 25.
25%, sorry. Yep. Sorry, 25%. The issue of fuel tax and road taxes is becoming more urgent, isn't it? I mean, Adrian and Mark both on the text line said, well, hang on, how far are we away from the government slapping a road tax on full EVs soon? Or Adrian says, so fuel buyers are still paying for it, are they?
This is an interesting one.
How far away are we from it?
Well, I don't know. I keep thinking every time the government's about to make announcements, I think, oh, this is great. They're going to bring it in here. Because I'm all for it. I think we should have a road user tax
on
it. The one thing I am against big time is having different systems across the different types of cars. And that's what has been mooted so far by government is, we'll bring in a road user tax on EVs and we'll keep the fuel excise on petrol and diesel, which just does not make any sense at all. Partly because, firstly, you've got hybrids. We've had hybrids in Australia now for 25 years. And all the hybrids on the road, the Toyota hybrids, for example, are paying roughly half the road user, the fuel excise that the non-hybrids are paying.
So there's an urgent need for major reform.
That is the straightaway inequality there. Yeah. It is such an easy sell, I think, to voters because if you take the fuel excise off, it's going to make petrol and diesel roughly 57, 58 cents a litre cheaper overnight. So straight away, guess what? You're paying a whole lot less for petrol and diesel. But there'll now be a road user charge and it will cost X amount of cents per kilometre.
Where would they collect that? At the point of registration?
No, it would have to be, registration each year, potentially. This is the challenge, I think, is how do you monitor it?
When do you levy it,
Do you make it self-reporting? So do people put it in and self-report, which then when you sell the car, but what happens if the car's, at the end of its life and trashed or something? So I don't... I think that's the harder part of it. But either way, there should be a road user charge across the board, not just on EVs.
What do other countries do? Do we know?
There are some countries with road user charges. I'm not sure off the top of my head which ones they are. But from memory, I think Russia was one that looked at it. But I can't remember which ones they are that have a road user charge. But either way, it's got to happen. But, keep in mind as well that fuel excise does not just go to repairing the roads.
It's a major source of revenue.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a major source 100%. Of revenue, some of which get, it all goes in the big bucket, I know, but, some of it goes to road maintenance.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And it's, you know, it opens a can of worms, because then people say, well, hang on, EVs are, you know, there's less, you're not making people sick and unwell from the exhaust emissions, all that sort of stuff. So do you counter it there? But I think the easiest way is just to say, okay, any cars using the road, get a road user charge.
Yeah. The question is, as I say, is where do you collect it? And how do you collect it?
Yeah, yeah.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Rodney from the Illawarra. G'day, Rodney.
How are you going, guys?
Not bad.
I just wanted to correct Toby on what he said about BYD service. I actually have two of them.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
And they're appalling.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Cool.
I bought a Shark 6. The car's great.
Yeah.
But I rang up because I knew they were having some problems with getting all the accessories and stuff.
Yep.
And they said they'd have it for me. So that was a week before I picked it up. I went to pick it up. They had nothing on it. Nothing at all. Oh, he made a big deal. We had floor mats in it. That was good.
Yeah.
And took me 8 months to get all my accessories
in. Yeah, wow.
I could have gone down to Ironman, who bought them all in, who were making them in China, and had them done in a week afterwards. So it was and they've just lied to me every time I've talked to them about something. And I've had a T-box go. That's a communication box.
Yeah.
I've had three of those in the car now. So I'm very disappointed with their service. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So you won't be rushing back. I mean, certainly the accessories on Shark, they did have issues with that early on. So that Shark 6 is the ute, and they did have issues with that early on in terms of, I think, just being able to fit them all, because so many people, the ute market, obviously a lot of people do fit accessories to their vehicles, whatever brand you're talking about. And it just seems they weren't prepared for that. So, and I think you've touched on an issue there, which is communication. So, you know, if you say to someone, hey, it's going to be, we're really sorry, but it's going to be, you know, 3 months or whatever we can do, then people, I guess, prepare for that. But if you keep saying it's going to be next week, that's when people get a bit frustrated.
It was worse than that, because they didn't have actually any of the accessories in stock at all. Then they had no one in their shops that could actually have the experience to fit them.
Yeah, I think my understanding is it's more the second issue than the first. I've spoken to someone who suggested the stock wasn't an issue. It was more the fitment that was the issue in the early days, because they had such a run on the car. So it was they just weren't quite ready for that. But
I don't believe that. They just didn't have any at all. Because there was, it was just so appalling that I couldn't get anything done. So.
Okay,
I'm happy. One of the really early people too.
So you won't be going for a third one then.
You won't be going for a third one then, Roddy.
The cars are good.
The cars are good. Yeah,
it's just the cars are good, but the people
who
are selling them. They've just treated me appallingly all this time.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Thanks, Rodney. Unhappy. We'll move on. Others want to have a say too, but unhappy customer on BYD service, not the car. Okay. Yeah. Okay. 1-300-800-222. Stefan from Canberra. G'day, Stefan.
Good evening, Philip. Good evening, Toby.
G'day.
I've got a question. I'd like to get your impressions of, we're looking at changing over our 11-year-old GLA 250. That's reaching 218,000 kilometres. And I've been looking at a number of EVs, but the current ones I've looked at is the BMW iX3. I've test-driven that, but the GLC 400 from Mercedes isn't quite here yet.
Yep.
What are your impressions of each one, and do you see one edging the other?
So obviously I haven't driven the GLC either. It's getting very good reviews over in the UK or over in Europe generally. I haven't driven that car though, so I can't give you anything on that. I have driven the BMW. I've only driven the 50, so the dual motor one, the more expensive one, and it was super impressive. So it was it's the longest range EV currently on sale in terms of claimed range, 805 kilometres, and it really exudes the BMW engineering that you know, they do really well across their petrol and diesel powered cars. So I was super impressed with it. The technology in it's really good, the way it drives is great. The little things like the braking system, the way they smooth the braking system is terrific. So it's a great car. But as I said, I just can't comment on the Merc at the moment, but you know, what I would say, BMW has made is far, has a far higher proportion of EVs that they're selling now. So they've made big inroads on that EV market to date, and they're really pushing really hard. And I was chatting to one of the product planners there 4 or 5 weeks ago, and he said that they're anticipating that by 2030, almost half their sales in Australia will be full battery electric vehicles. So they'll be they're expecting significant growth in terms of their EVs, even from where they are now.
Yeah, that's one of the things I noticed was that, and it's frustrating for us because we're almost ready to change over, but BMW's way ahead. I mean, their cars are in the showroom, they're on the road being tested, you can drive them. But anyway, we'll wait to see with the other one, because one thing that's key for us is long-distance driving. We drive a lot for family and friends to Melbourne, into the Mallee area, Bendigo. So, you know, I don't expect to do it in one charge, but the fewer charges I have, the better. So the 800 claimed ranges are really enticing for us.
So just be careful with that 800k range. So you're not going to get 800 kilometers on the freeway.
Out of it. No.
You'll be more like. So I've actually just done a story. This is on evcentral.com.au on exactly this. Basically, I said how long will it take to drive 1,000 kilometers? And I've crunched, well, I used AI to crunch all the data in terms of go through all the data that we had and work out exactly how long it would take to go that 1,000 kilometers. The BMW, that iX3, was the fastest, and it was to do 1,000 kilometres, it'll take 24 minutes of charging to do the whole thing in a single charging session. So it was the only car on the list that will do it in one charge. Everything else, there's 300-odd cars on the list, everything else will need between 2 and 9 charges to get there. But it's a as I said, you've got to be wary of that 805k's range. You then knock that down about 20% for freeway driving, then you say, okay, you're not gonna drain it to zero. You get down to say 10%, and then when you charge on a road trip, you very rarely charge. You don't charge to 100%. You'll only charge up to say 80. So call it 500 and something k's, 550 odd for that first charge when you leave home full, and maybe 400 odd for the next top up. So it's it just takes a little bit of thinking from that perspective.
Okay.
I mean, I'm quite happy for one charge rather than 9.
Exactly. Well, the 9 was the Hilux, so it's the, which they've never pitched that electric Hilux as a road trip car at all. It's designed for, you know, mine sites and back to base sort of stuff. So it's not designed for road trips, but it's got short range and not designed for things like that.
Sure.
But, yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen. Stefan. 1-300-800-222 is the number. When are they going to ditch the luxury car tax? Says my texter. This was only ever brought in to protect the Statesman Caprice and the Fairlane LTD. At the time, they were great cars, but they're dinosaurs now, and there are no luxury cars to protect. Is there a luxury car tax?
Because the government's hooked on the revenue, I think. Yeah. So it's I can't remember what it was last time I looked at billion dollars.
So many things here. The government won't these taxes are unfair and stupid.
No, and the last time someone crunched the numbers publicly, and I think it'd still be the same now. The brand that pays more luxury car tax than anyone else is Toyota, because Land Cruisers.
Land Cruisers, yeah.
A lot of Prados cop it. So they're selling a lot of cars that go over that. It's two limits. You've got a fuel efficient limit, 91,000, and the other limit for other cars, 75,000. So, I think the luxury car tax is ridiculous. Like, it does not make sense at all for those reasons that the listeners pointed out. But also, it is literally the only item in the country that gets a luxury tax. Like, you can buy a helicopter or a yacht or
spend luxury watch.
$1 million on a diamond ring. You don't pay any luxury tax, but you buy a Toyota Land Cruiser and you cop it. So
buy a $10 million house and you don't get a luxury car tax.
That's it. So it is. It's crazy. As I said, I think the reason it hasn't gone is because they're hooked on the revenue and they need to find another way to make money from it.
Run 300-800-222. This is Motor Talk with Toby Hagen. One of my texters who doesn't put your name on the text, people, because then we know who we're talking to. When should I sell my 2022 Mazda CX-5 front-wheel drive, 60,000 k's? Has the bottom fallen out of the internal combustion engine second-hand market?
No, not at all.
Not really.
I mean, it's you know, we've seen, obviously, as I pointed out, EV residual values step up a bit in the last 4 or 5 months. We've seen some particularly larger diesel, you know, utes and so on, come off a bit in the last 4 or 5 months. And But no, it's not. The bottom's not going to fall out of it. And to some extent, it'll depend on other things going on. So, you know, fuel prices are relatively high now, and that obviously hurts thirstier vehicles. But if fuel prices drop, I would imagine the values of those cars might inch up a bit. Conversely, if fuel prices keep going north, then they might go down more. But I wouldn't be worried about the bottom dropping out of it. You're not going to wake up tomorrow and suddenly they're worth half the price. You know, all cars depreciate pretty much, and you know, you'd expect it to keep going down, but I wouldn't expect it to just significantly drop.
Hayden in Brisbane. Hello, Hayden. G'day, Hayden.
Yeah, I'm wondering about a Isuzu diesel SUV. Is that a good buy this time of with the price of diesel?
Yeah, it depends how much you're happy to spend on diesel, I guess. So, and it depends what you want to use it for. You know, the at the moment, if you want to go serious remote outback touring, then or heavy duty towing, then you're pretty much looking at diesel. That's mostly where you're looking. There's a few plug-in hybrids that are these days starting to encroach on that diesel market. But yeah, it's very much a diesel market for that sort of thing. If you just want a car to tool around town and not go off road, I wouldn't have an Isuzu MU-X at the top of my list because it is a proper off roader. It's designed for heavy duty off roading and towing. So yeah, keep that in mind. But you know, depending on what you're chasing, it is it's a decent car. It's, you know, the only thing I'd say, there's two engine options. You've either got the 3 liter. Or the 2.2. The 2.2 is a pretty ordinary engine. It's got lag. It's a little bit underpowered. It's not much fun to drive around. But the 3 liter is a more solid unit for sure.
Okay. Alrighty. Good luck with it, Hayden. This is Motor Talk.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Rhonda in Donvar. G'day, Rhonda.
Yeah. Hi, Toby and Philip. I've got a second-hand Audi I bought about a year and a half ago. It's an A3. It's done about 46,000 kilometres. And I'm just thinking, I've had it all checked out. It's all great. So what would you think I could, just local, not much country driving, that I should keep that before I upgrade, please?
You're wanting to work out whether to keep it or...
Keep it or move it on?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to move on to? So you're just like, what sort of driving are you doing in it now? And what's if you upgraded, what sort of car would you want? Would you want another sort of luxury hatchback?
Pretty much very local driving. So very, very low kilometres. But whether I just keep this while it's got a good resale, or should I upgrade to Nick? I'd like another Audi. European.
I'm not sure. But, I mean, a car like that. It's what year model is it roughly?
It's a 2019 A3.
Yeah, I mean, you should still have, you know, it's obviously got plenty of life left in it yet with low Ks like that on it. I wouldn't be rushing out of it at this stage to go and upgrade for the sake of upgrading and get a similar style of car. So that end of the market, those sort of small, sedans and hatchbacks, small luxury ones like that, hasn't changed enormously in the last few years, so you're still going to be getting a similar style of car. Yes, they've refined things. Yes, there's more tech in the newer ones, all that sort of stuff. But you've still got a pretty good car. I'm not sure I'll be rushing out of it to just upgrade. So, I'd be happy to stick with it, for another couple of years. And then, you know, you'll see the market. We've got, you know, the CO2 emissions regulations are now in. They're tightening enormously next year and again the year after. So you're going to start to see a lot more different vehicles, and particularly more plug-in hybrids and EVs coming in over the next couple of years. You'll get more choice, basically. So, yeah, stick with what you've got and see what happens in the new car market.
Thanks, Rhonda.
Terrific.
See ya.
Thanks, Toby.
Bye. Liz in Nelson Bay. G'day, Liz.
Yeah, good evening.
New batteries. Go on.
Yeah, question. There's a saline ion battery being developed in China. Is that sneaking into the automotive market?
Not that I'm aware of. So there's basically two main battery chemistries now being used in EVs, and there are another two or three being developed that I'm aware of. Some are available overseas now, like sodium ion. There's solid-state batteries and other things kicking in. So there's more technologies coming. That said, there's a lot of... There's a lot of battery chemistries being experimented with, and sometimes they appear in consumer electronics and so on first. The challenge the car industry often has with batteries is they need such an enormous, you know, a massive battery to make the car move, and it's building it in scale at an affordable price is the challenge. So that's the massive challenge they've had with solid-state batteries. The technology's been around for, you know, 15-plus years, but getting it into a car at a price that they can afford and manufacturing it to the levels they want has been the challenge. So I'm not aware of those, that one you mentioned, but it'll be one of the many. Yeah.
Sodium ion, yeah.
Are you saying sodium ion?
Yeah, sodium ion.
I thought you said something else. Yeah. Sodium ion, yeah, is available now in China. So that is here now in some Chinese cars. It's not in any cars in Australia yet. But, I mean, the big thing is that it exchanges lithium, which is quite an expensive component, for sodium salt. So it's a lot cheaper to manufacture. But the energy density on them is a lot less. So essentially you need a bigger battery to do the same job. So the experts I've spoken to have said they're expecting sodium ion batteries to be used in sort of cheaper, more city cars. So, you know, smaller hatchbacks, maybe 400 or 500 km range rather than expensive cars with longer range. So it is on the way, but not in Australia yet.
Okay. Alrighty, thanks, Les. Michael in Perth. G'day, Michael.
G'day, gentlemen. How are we?
Very well.
Good.
Toby, I'll just after your expertise opinion on the Ford Ranger Super Duty and what your thoughts are, I've just purchased one. I absolutely love it. I just wanted your opinion on it, that's all.
Yeah, Super Duty is a great thing. Obviously, the big thing with it is it can tow more and carry more. So whereas your average ute is around 1 ton payload and 3.5 tons towing, that thing's 4.5 ton towing and sort of 1.8-odd ton payload. So the market it's filling, it was designed initially for that for work purposes, you know, like forestry workers and mining fleets and that sort of stuff. But they're finding there's a pretty solid market there too for adventurers and people who are off towing, taking the family out towing and so on, and dragging around a big caravan. So they're finding it's working pretty well for that. The big thing, it is engineered from the ground up to do all that work. So whereas you can get a GVM upgrade, a gross vehicle mass upgrade, on a regular ute, it doesn't have the thicker chassis, the longer rear suspension, like the it's got longer leaf springs in the rear suspension, bigger diffs, all that sort of stuff. So it is from the ground up engineered to carry heavier loads. So it does a good job. And it does feel slower than a normal Ranger because it's two reasons. One is you got more weight, and the second one is the wheels are a bigger rolling radius. So it's slightly differently geared, I guess, in terms of how it drives. The final gear ratio is essentially slightly different. So it is slower than a normal Ranger, but it's it's still pretty decent, and in terms of what it can tow and what it can lift, it's pretty impressive. Sure. And it doesn't have the compromises, as many compromises, that you get with a GVM upgrade car, which can sometimes mean, say, harder suspension, much stiffer suspension. This one doesn't have quite those compromises.
If you want to do the big lap, it's a reasonable option.
Yeah, I mean, it's not cheap. That is the big negative. It's sort of 100 grand. So it's the base car is pretty basic. Yeah. So it's not cheap, but if you genuinely want to load it with accessories, load it with gear, do big adventuring, heavy duty off roading, it's a great car. If you're just going to tool around town in it, it's not the car for you.
It's not the car. Get a smaller battery. Okay. Righto. Thanks, Michael. I hope you enjoy the car. Kevin wants to know about fuel. G'day, Kevin.
Hey, evening, gents. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
I've got two cars in my garage. One's a Golf and the other is a Audi Q5. Mm-hmm. The label on the fuel point says I should be using 95 RON in them, but 95 RON's a bit scarce in most service stations. They usually only got 91 or 98, and the 98 can be, you know, sometimes 30 cents a litre more.
Yeah. Yeah.
My understanding is I should be using the appropriate RON to get the full potential of the car performance, but most of my driving is suburban driving. I'm not looking to
get full performance. Yeah.
My question is there any significant downside in using 91?
That's a good – yeah, just before we go on, Toby, Rhonda from Castle Hill wants the same question. She said, we just bought a new RAV4 hybrid.
Yeah.
The dealer says it needs to take 95 fuel, but is that correct? What would happen if we just use 91?
Yeah, so there's two issues at play. One is what the potential drop-off in performance, which is fairly minor, but the car can feel a little bit flat when you're running the lower octane fuel. But these days, the computers account for that. So it's not going to necessarily damage the engine from that perspective. Where the potential issue kicks in, particularly with the Golf, and I'm not quite sure with the RAV, because the RAV4, I've actually asked Toyota this, and I can't remember the answer I got, but because some of that engine, some of the cars that use the same engine run on 91 and some run on premium unleaded. And I'm sort of saying to them, why does that one use that and that use that?
But same engine.
Anyway. Mm. So the Golf, the challenge with the Golf is in Australia, premium unleaded fuel has the regulations stipulate that it must have a lower sulfur level. And Volkswagen, I remember years ago saying that they didn't want people using that low octane fuel because it could potentially have a higher sulfur level and therefore damage the emission system in the car, the exhaust system and so on in the car. So that's one of the big reasons they said. So that would be my biggest concern over the performance issue and all that side of it. As I said, the computers will work out that side these days. It's more the higher sulfur. You know, that said, you can get plenty of regular unleaded with lower sulfur levels, but which one's got it? Who knows? So as a general rule, I would say put in what they recommend. Obviously, there's no harm going over. You can do the 98, but as you pointed out, it's more expensive. So that's a bit of a challenge.
Mm, okay.
Fair enough. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Kevin. Bye-bye. Appreciate your call. Can you ask how are we going to go with a full EV and a ute going to go towing a decent-sized boat or a large caravan going long distances, says Mark. Well, as you've said many times, Toby, this is where diesels are at the moment, and they will be for a while.
Yeah, they will, absolutely. If you fast forward out 5 or 10 years, it's not going to be an issue. So, and once you get the utes with, call it 800 k's of claimed range, so they might do 400 when they're towing a heavy load. And once you get the fast charging infrastructure and you've only got to stop for 6, 8, 10 minutes, then I don't think it's going to be a major issue. But that is, we're talking years away for that. At the moment, it's diesels or, as I touched on earlier, plug-in hybrids, and we're starting to see those plug-in hybrids more infiltrate into that ute market. Mm. Chery, for example, later this year is going to have a car called the Stockman, and that'll be the first diesel hybrid ute in Australia. So they're trying to combine the best of both worlds. They're actually going to offer it as a diesel hybrid and a petrol hybrid. And I think they're getting a straight diesel model as well. So it's it'd be interesting to see what the take up is on which way people jump.
Yep, Andrew from Oxford. G'day, Andrew.
Oh, g'day. I drove from Darwin back to Sydney in a hybrid Prado. It was a very good trip.
Mm-hmm.
Looking to buy my own vehicle this time. I've got a 2015 long wheelbase Toyota Hiace petrol. But it's limited on where it can go, like the four-wheel drive roads, the Gibb River and Litchfield, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at either a Land Cruiser, but I'm told that they're not worth the money for a long trip like that, like for what they cost.
Mm-hmm.
I was told, you know, look at something like an older Prado or a Kluger, something like that. Any other car you might suggest?
So one tiny thing on the Prado is Toyota doesn't call that car a hybrid. Yes, it's got the little blue triangle, the EV triangle on the number plate, and it is essentially a mild hybrid, but they'll never call it a hybrid. They call it a 48-volt assist system. So it's extremely, extremely mild hybrid. It's not really a hybrid, essentially. In terms of what to look at, interesting you say Land Cruisers aren't worth the money. Land Cruisers are expensive, absolutely. They are not cheap cars, and you can spend over 150 grand on a Land Cruiser. But go and have a look at the resale values on Land Cruisers, and you start to realise why people don't have a major issue, because they can drive them for 10 years and still step out of them and sell them for decent money at the end of it. So you get a bit of that paid back when you go to sell the car. And they're certainly terrific cars for that sort of driving. I've done plenty of trips in Land Cruisers. I've driven To Broome in one. I've driven across the Simpson in one. I've gone north, south, the whole bit. So there's in all different ones. So it's so they do a good job of it. Interesting you mentioned Prado and Kluger. The Prado is certainly the pick. If you're looking at Gibb River Road and that sort of thing, you're going to want a Prado over a Kluger for sure. These days, a modern Kluger doesn't get a full-size spare tyre, for example, and you're going to need that on something like the Gibb River Road. So, you know, look at a Prado.
Need two spare tyres.
Yes, potentially. I've got we had a car where we got two flats in one hit on the Gibb River Road, so that was fun. Changing that at 7 o'clock at night or something is always good. But, yeah, so, you know, consider other things too. Ford Everest, that Isuzu MU-X that was touched on earlier. A lot of those cars will all do a great job on that sort of trip. But if you're looking at secondhand, I'd be looking at condition as much as anything. You know, you can buy a 10 or 15 year old four-wheel drive that's done some pretty hard work and looks pretty ratty, whereas you can get one that's just done the school run and is in pretty mint condition. And as I said, I'll be looking on at the condition of the car, how it's been used, whether it's been heavy duty towing for its life, all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Thank you very kindly.
No worries, Andrew. Thank you. Bye. Yes, thanks for the show, says a number of texters here. How about this one, Toby? Could you ask Toby if you put half 98 and half 91 in the tank, does that equate to about 95?
I'm sure there would be some blend that would get you to 95 somehow. Whether you're then going to have the sulfur
issue. Is there any issue about mixing it up?
No. You can mix them up, absolutely. But if the car stipulates premium unleaded, I would still be going for that, as I said, just to be belt and braces, particularly on a newer car. You know, if you had a 20-year-old car that you weren't too worried about, maybe throw some older stuff in that. But I'd be recommending generally to put the recommended fuel in there. But, yeah, I mean, there'd be some way to blend it to get 95 from 91 and 98, but good luck guessing it.
Jace in the Beldo. Sorry, Jace, you've been hanging on there. Sorry. But hello.
Oh, that's okay. Hi, Phil and Toby. Thanks for the opportunity to have a talk. I was looking for a motor vehicle to exchange my 2021 CHR with, which I absolutely adored. I ended up going with the RAV4, the hybrid. I took your good word on it, Toby, and ordered one and purchased one. I just want to say that I'm really, really impressed. I'm a social worker and a counsellor, and I do a lot of Ks, and just off one tank of fuel, and I've still got 43 Ks left, I've done 1,060 kilometres.
Wow, it's good going.
I'm stoked.
Yeah, it'd be as much as you get from a from something like that, I would have thought. Yeah, I mean, look, it's are you doing mainly sort of suburban or around town, or are you doing out country stuff?
It's around town.
Around town.
On the freeway a little bit, et cetera. So the only thing is it's probably not as much bang for the buck as other cars in around that sort of area.
No.
But, and I say that in regards to GXL, so it's not got all the special seats and all the, the smoke and whistles, but it's very, very nice car.
Yeah, it's a terrific car, but as you pointed out, there's a price premium there to it, but a lot of people are prepared to pay it, partly because, you know, as I touched on earlier, the residual value tends to be fairly solid on them. They do pay it back. But there's a lot of, I pointed this out before, you look in that mid-sized SUV market, which is the single biggest segment in Australia, and there are some terrific alternatives to that car. So the RAV4 is great, and it is one of the best hybrid systems on the market. It's a terrific hybrid system, but you look at a Nissan X-Trail e-Power, it's great buying. Kia Sportage hybrid, Hyundai Tucson hybrid, Honda CR-V, all those cars are really great. They all have great hybrid systems for slightly different reasons, but there's some great options in that market.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to highlight that it's done 1,060 kilometres. I still have 43 Ks left in the tank, which is brilliant.
That's good going.
Thanks, sure. Chase. Good on you, mate. Appreciate the call. Gee, look, time has disappeared on us. Nadine in Abbotsford says, thanks for the show, enjoying it. Is the Subaru Forester hybrid any good?
It is. So I mentioned all those cars just a second ago that are also good. And I think ultimately they're slightly better hybrid systems, all the other ones I talked about. The current Forester hybrid is a much better bet than the original one. The original one was pretty underwhelming. It was basically a mild hybrid. So the last 18 months, 2 years, it's been really good. But its real strength is not so much its hybrid system, which is good rather than great. It's the rest of the car. So the rest of the car is terrific in terms of particularly its light-duty off-road ability. It's great if you do want to get the tyres dirty. It's also a pretty good driving car generally. So it's a good car, but as I said, the hybrid system, it's not its standout. It just ticks the box.
David on the Central Coast says, most E10, we're talking about fuel again, most E10s about 94.
Yeah, that's right.
So is that actually an option?
Well, it depends if the car is approved for E10.
Right.
But, I mean, theoretically, no, because of the 95, 94 thing. But so, again, I'd go with the recommendation. But, yeah, because ethanol has a higher octane rating than petrol. So once you blend the two, you generally end up with a higher rating. Years ago, there was, I think it was Shell was doing 100 octane fuel. So they were doing 100 octane fuel that was that people would go and sniff out for, like, search out for to put in their performance cars. And I remember chatting to Ampol, ended up doing E85. It was pretty short-lived, but a blend of up to 85% ethanol, 15% petrol. And I remember them saying at the time that they'd put it into a petrol station. I think it was in Sydney somewhere, and there weren't any cars yet that could take it, but suddenly their sales ramped up and they couldn't work it out. So they went out to the service station to have a look. One of the execs went out. And it turned out it was guys with modified cars, hotted up cars, who'd worked out it was 102 or 3 octane or something. So they were tuning their cars specifically to run on E85. It was an easy win for them. They could basically get the car to boost, 5 or 10% power just by buying this fuel. So it was so they were loving it.
Dear, oh dear. All right. Just before you go, you've been driving the Mazda 6E.
I have. Someone asked about this a few weeks ago, and so this is essentially it's a rebadged D-PAL, which D-PAL is one of the Chinese brands, it's on sale here. But the 6E is, if you look at a D-PAL L07, it's basically that car, slightly different grille and stuff. It doesn't feel anything like a Mazda. It looks like a Mazda, but to drive and to live in, it doesn't feel like a Mazda. So I think anyone stepping out of a Mazda previously might think, wow, what's going on here? But the car itself is decent. It drives pretty well. The frustration I've got is the infotainment system is so screen-based. So you've got to go digging into menus and so on to do sometimes basic features. So that takes some getting used to. But the car is decent. The one challenge it's going to have is the Tesla Model 3, which is a direct competitor, and ultimately the Tesla, I think, is a better thing.
Okie doke. Toby, it's been terrific, as always. Brilliant. So happy motoring. See you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Toby Hagen will be back. If you want to contact him, by the way, you can do it via advice@evcentral.com.au.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.